Woodworkers for the Blind presents Dan Parker, a fellow woodworker, machinist, car builder, and who happens to be the fastest blind man in the world.
I actually built race cars for a living, and I was the 2005 American Drag Racing League Pro Nitrous World Champion. On March 31st, 2012, had a very violent wreck, 175. Car went through the wall, just went to flipping and tumbling. Car broke apart. There was nothing left forward of my feet. No motor, transmission, firewall, anything. Well, I was beat up so bad they had to put me in a coma, and they didn't attend to my brain pressure. My brain swelled, compressed my optic nerve, and killed it. So my total, 100%. When I started LCB, I'd barely nailed two by fours together. Check out that finger joint jig. You can just go to YouTube and just search Dan Parker finger joint jig. And I hope maybe give an explanation and check it out.
And you can find Woodworkers for the Blind on the web at www4b.org.
A lot of blind and visually impaired woodworkers sharing ideas, thoughts, projects, and a lot of how-to-dos with each other. It's a great community. Check it out, www4b.org. Now our host, Daryl Vickers, will take it away.
Welcome, everybody, to the Woodworking for the Blind December call. First, I want to wish everybody a Merry Christmas and or Happy Holidays. It doesn't feel much like Christmas around here, I'll tell you. But, it did today, but it's about the only day it has. Also, in January, I put out a little thing the other day. Call's going to feature a company called MicroJig, and I'm pretty excited to have them on because I have some of their products and really like them. So that will be coming up next month. And having said all that, Mr. Dan, welcome, sir.
Please excuse me. I've been fighting a cold the last few days. Just please excuse me, but we're going to get through it if we can.
That's understandable. I got getting over something myself. For those of you who don't know, Dan joined us a few years ago, probably quite a few now since time flies by, but Dan is a drag racer. It's also one of Daryl's passions. So Dan's on this call, maybe not as much about woodworking as it is about racing and stuff like that, because I absolutely love it, though I would never ever had the guts to do it myself. But it is a fun thing to watch from afar. So, Mr. Dan, if you will give us some background, first of all, on yourself and tell us how you got started and all that.
Yeah, so growing up, I realized I sucked at stick and ball sports and struggled through regular academics in school, but I excelled at machine shop and welding. And I was a welder machinist my whole life. I actually built race cars for a living, and I was the 2005 American Drag Racing League Pro Nitrous World Champion. So those are the fastest door cars on the planet. They still have a left side operating door. 0 to 75 in about 1 second. 0 to 200 in 4 seconds. And on March 31st, 2012, had a very violent wreck, 175. Car went through the wall, just went to flipping and tumbling. Car broke apart. There was nothing left forward of my feet. No motor, transmission, firewall, anything. Well, I was beat up so bad they had to put me in a coma, and they didn't attend to my brain pressures. My brain swole, compressed my optic nerve, and killed it. So my total, 100%. And after coming home, fighting the pressure real hard, about 6 months in, I was on the verge of suicide, and it came to me in a dream that I could build a motorcycle and become the first blind man to race the famed Bonneville Salt Flats. And with just a lot of blessings, friends and family and sponsors and people donating time, 10 months later, in 2013, I did so. I returned in 14 and set my official FIM class record with no exemptions for blindness. Is still to date, I'm the only blind man in the world that's ever raced with no human assistance. I have a custom guidance system built by a good friend of mine at Boeing Phantom Works that gives me audible feedback. I never did any woodworking before I went blind, but during that time, in 14, I was enrolled at LCB, Louisiana Center for the Blind, and I took woodshop and really took to it. When I came home, I started doing woodworking, and I was making some really beautiful lamps that were tapered. So they were about 16 inches tall, about 9 inches at the base, and I think about 5 inches at the top, and they were finger jointed all the way down the side. And I designed a finger joint jig that I could do all those finger joints, so 3/4 joints, and there'll be zero putty in the lamps that's finished. The tolerance are so tight, but sadly, in 17, I had to give up all my woodwork equipment because my shop is so small at home. It's a 20 by 30, and so I still have my metal lathe and mill machine and sheet metal equipment because I bought a used flood salvage 2008 Corvette to start building to attempt the Guinness record for the fastest car driven blindfolded, which was held by Mike Newman in England at 200.5 miles per hour. and that made Mike the fastest blind man in the world. So 17, we started it. End of 19, it was fairly close. It just got painted, and I was approached by the producers of Jay Leno's Garage. They wanted me to film an episode in the February, and that gave me enough time, and with a commitment to them, borrow some sponsors, they'll pay to have the car finished, some of the final stuff that needed to be done, and get the motor finished and dyno tuned and, you know, rig up and going. And we filmed the show. I went 153.8, and that was the first full pass I made on the car with a new guided system, because the one for the car is so much more intricate compared to the motorcycle because of the speed. So, you know, the motorcycle, my record is 62.05 miles per hour. It was a 70cc two-stroke three-wheeler. Then when COVID hit, I thought my race was over with. And then in 2021, President Rick Abono reached out to me and asked if, because the Blind Driver Challenge, the NFB sponsored me for the motorcycle, asked me if I'm trying to attempt the Guinness record for the 10-year anniversary of the Blind Driver Challenge. And of course, I accepted the challenge and we started putting all the plans together. And in the fall of 2021, the Timely Association that was supposed to do the clocks, the owner got COVID and he was on the ventilator for 8 weeks, and it was a miracle he lived. So we had to postpone it, and we rented the Spaceport, New Mexico in March. And after a couple really tough days of testing, on the last day, with just about an hour and a half left, I set the Guinness record with a 2A average speed of 211.043 miles per hour. And that made me the fastest blind man on earth. And so I followed the Woodworker for the Blind group. I know some of y'all in here, Daryl, George, Ray, and Jeff. You know, I don't contribute much, but I enjoy reading all the topics, the feedback, and getting to learn about some of the new stuff. And I think I was a member damn near since I came on from LCB in 15.
Yeah, you've been with us a long time.
Yeah. So now I hand machine custom writing pens. Years ago, Ray helped me learn how to turn wood pins. And when I was building the Corvette one night, I was playing around. I made five polished pins using the pin kits for the wood, but I would drill and ream my aluminum parts to the ID of the brass tubes. And I put it on the internet. I said, I'm going to give these to sponsors. If anybody wants to donate $50 to the Corvette, I'll make and send you a pin. Hell, next morning I woke up, I had 12 orders. And so now I have three different styles, a slim, an executive, which is like a cigar diameter. And then my Made in America during COVID, I set out to design a 100% Made in America pin. And it's got seven hand machine parts, including a bolt action mechanism that makes the ink cartridge coming in and out. And then I have an aluminum base that's 3/8 thick that I round over the edges with a wood router, and it's got two vertical little stands that's notched so the pin perfectly sets those saddles, and this laser engraved, and it says this pin was 100% designed and hand machined by Dan Parker, the blind machinist, and my life motto, you can make excuses or make it happen. And so Patrick, the engineer that builds my guidance system, he hacked into my digital readout on my mill machine and made it speak. So I have a foot pedal for X and Y. Then, of course, I have a talk box, my Mitutoyo calipers and micrometer. Obviously, use my click rule, a bunch of stuff that ain't super accurate. And I stay fairly busy at my shop most days. I sell my pens on my website, theblindmachinist.com.
Well, that's really cool. And you covered a lot of stuff in a very short period of time. You don't get off that easy. I want to go back, first of all, how old were you when you got in your first drag race?
I was 8 years old. I only lived 15 miles from my local drag strip, and they used to have an all-motorcycle race once a year. They had a mini-bike class, and Dad entered me in the mini-bike class when I was 8. I came in second place. I was 12 the first time I went down the drag strip in a car, and I started racing, bracket racing straight out of high school. I graduated in 88 and progressively went faster and faster, and then I started driving some fast cars for people. In 1997, I was given the opportunity to drive my first Pro Mod car for a local man. It was a 57 Chevrolet, and I was hooked from life, because Pro Mods are wild. They're like, I tell people, a rodeo cowboy trying to ride a bull for 8 seconds, and we're trying to ride one for 4 seconds. It's got, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 horsepower depending on the engine combination. They're a handful.
Oh, that's incredible. So going back, you started out building your own cars? Is that right?
Yeah. So my dad is a racer, so I'm second generation. I always helped him build cars. And in the 90s, I had my own machine shop, and my main customer was a Japanese battery plant. They was moving it to Mexico. I said, well, I got to do something a little different. And I was already getting burned out. So I had been building race cars on the side, I guess about 96 or 97. I went full time, and I was still building race cars in 2012 when I had my wreck. I was very proficient in TIG welding, sheet metal work, bending, tubing, all the design. Plus, I did a lot of tuning, because the Pro Mod I drove, I was responsible for tuning from the firewall back. the clutch, the engine management system, the suspension, everything else, plus driving. And my car owner, he would tune the motor. That's what his specialty was, engines. And so it worked out good. You know, we had other people on the team, but it just worked out good, particular situation. And I drove from him from 1999 to 2012.
So, you know, growing up too, we had a drag strip that wasn't too far from me. And like I said, I love to watch them. Where would we see the car that you actually wrecked, since it, I'm not familiar with that class? We see NHRA and everything on TV and everything, but where does that class, do all big tracks run your class of car?
Yes. So the NHRA now has Pro Modified as a regular class. They don't run at every event. I think they run at 12 or 14 events. And then there's the PDRA, the Pro Drag Racer Association. They run Pro Modified, American Drag Racing League. And then there's several other outlaw races throughout the year. If you're on YouTube, you can just search Dan Parker, Valdosta, Georgia, ADRL. And there's a little 3-minute video that I compiled years ago before I went blind of a race that I raced in 2008. And in the final, we were the first side-by-side 3-second pass in Pro Nitrous history. So that meant me and the guy in the finals both went under 4.000. I lost in the final. That's a little video that you can listen to and hear how fast those cars accelerate. Because it's, like I said, 0-200 in 4 seconds, basically.
Well, that's the problem with drag racing, especially now. And if you can't see, all you hear is this loud noise, and it shuts off in the race. You're done. The guys don't even have time to tell you anymore what's going on. They go so fast.
Yep.
But so I know at Pro Modified, I know that class. So that class just means that the driver, one of the things is the driver's door opens.
Yeah. So it's the fastest door car. So a door car still has the working doors, whereas like a funny car, the body lifts up at the front, pivots to the back, and the dragster's real long. And so in Pro Modified, there's several engine combinations. You can have nitrous, turbochargers, superchargers. There's a variety of engine combinations, and anything from a 40 Willis to a new Camaro, everything in between.
Right. Okay. Well, that's really cool. So I never knew that about that class, I guess. I always thought that was so much of that was just all motor stuff.
Oh, no. The new modern Pro Nitrous motors are 959 cubic inches plus 6 stages of nitrous oxide. And they'll make a legit 3,500 horsepower to the rear wheels. So now they actually have what's called hub dynos. So the dyno bolts to the axles. You take the wheels and tires off, and the dyno bolts to the axles so it can measure true rear wheel horsepower. And they can actually simulate a complete run on a hub dyno now, and allows them to tune everything in the shop besides traction and the chassis, as far as the motor and the fuel injection, engine management, everything else.
So I find that just amazing how what they could do nowadays, you know.
Technology has gone crazy in drag racing the last 10 years. You know, I never could afford it. I was blessed to be able to drive for people, but the day of my wreck, the motor is brand new that day. Never been on the racetrack. It was $90,000. It was damn near a piece of scrap whenever the pass was over with. The new modern motors are 125 for a Pro Nitrous motor.
Yeah, expensive sports.
Yeah. You know,
so how fast would your car go? I know seconds, but I don't know what that is in miles per hour. You know what I'm saying?
I think 190 miles an hour in the eighth of a mile was the fastest we went.
And an eighth.
Wow. Yeah, under 4 seconds, 190. That was with the motor before the pass I wrecked. I went 175, but it was only on 2 small kits of nitrous because we were testing. And with the motor I wrecked, if we just stretched it through the quarter mile, it went between 245 and 250 miles per hour.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. So, Dan, if you're running that fast, so when do you catch your breath, or how do you keep up with everything you have to do in such a short time?
It becomes second nature to you. You know, you don't think about anything, because if you think about it, it's too late. You know, something's going to happen. I never measured my breath while I actually go down the track. Hell, I might have held my breath. I don't know. But I know, you know, when you pull that parachute, you feel that thing tug, you know, that pass so with and everything's good at that point. So you can go back to breathing, you know. But the level of competition that I raced at, you're just racing against the baddest folks there is. Every pass was a challenge, you know. You weren't racing soft folks in that class.
Right. Yeah. It's incredible. Like I said, I always love all types of racing. But when I was young, drag racing was just the thing for me. If I could see it, I'd still be there watching it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So for all my woodworking guys here, humored me for a little bit. I want to go back to your lamps, because you made this jig for cutting box joints. And it is a very interesting jig. It's different from anyone that I've ever heard before. And I kind of want you to give that some more detail, if you would, as
okay,
how you made it, how it works.
So what I did, I knew I needed to make the sled, then I needed to be able to move the lamp. So I went to my milling machine and I drilled, you know, I got it was 3/4. I think I ripped a piece about 4 inches wide and I ripped another piece identical. Then I put a shim in my vise so that piece would barely slide. So I drilled a hole and put a dowel in it and then drilled a corresponding hole on the piece I wanted to move. So I would offset my table 3/4 of an inch. I first took my sled part, drilled it, picked it up, slid that hole on top of the dowel, drilled it, et cetera, down. So that made a series of holes exactly 3/4 of an inch apart. I'm talking about to the thousandths. Then I ripped it down the middle of all those holes. So I had two long boards that had half moons in them. So the part attached to the sled, I glued dowels in those half moons. So then the other piece, the half moons would fit perfectly on center on those dowels. Then I finished the rest of the sled. So, you know, you would push it forward, cut your 3/4, you know, groove, then pick it up and did these on 1.5 inches because the way the offset is. Anyway, it made a perfect 3/4 notch and a 3/4 stud. And I never knew if anybody else made anything like it, but just being a machinist and me thinking how I could make this accurate, because I was making them with a typical finger joint jig that you had to pick up and all that. And if there's any error, it would accumulate down to the 16 inches of the lamps. And, you know, down at the end, you might have an 1/8 inch or 1/4 inch gap. If you go on YouTube, there's a video. You can just search Dan Parker new finger joint jig. And it's a video of me showing how it works. And I'm telling you, those last probably 10 lamps I made had zero putty in them because I would use dark and light wood. So all the way down the joints was dark light, it just super accurate way. You know, I use my calipers to measure my width for my, you know, gang and my blades. So I was cutting exact, you know, 3/4, 750, 755 thousandths slot. You know, and I was trying to make it that accurate.
Well, that jig is unique because I've never heard one like that. Leave it up to a metal guy to figure that out. But I would think that would be actually, once you had it made, a lot easier to use probably.
Oh, it was super easy because
for being accurate and everything.
It was super accurate. And then I was making, you know, batches of 4 to 5 lamps at a time, and I could have all my boards laid out and I could finger joint all the boards for all those lamps in probably 1.5-2 hours. The biggest thing I found was that the sawdust every now and then would get in those radiuses or in the half moons. So you periodically had to clean out those. About every 4 cuts, I'd make sure that they were cleaned out really good. It worked great because you had your one at the bottom. You'd have to offset because at the very bottom, one would have a receiver groove and one would be a stud, you know, for the two sides. But once you got all that figured out, it worked amazing.
Well, I'm glad to know that your jig still got affected by sawdust because, you know, that dries.
Oh, yeah.
When you're doing finger joints and dovetail, it's amazing what a little sawdust can, how it can drive you crazy when you're trying to fit a joint.
Yeah.
And the second question on your lamps, because I've always wanted to ask you this, and I don't think I ever have. Your lamps, were you gluing boards together? And I mean, on the height of your lamp, were you doing that just out of one board long grain, or were you gluing them together and making cross grain cuts?
Mainly just long grain. You know, to tell you the truth, I didn't really pay that much attention to it. You know,
didn't glue a bunch of boards together to get 16 inches tall.
Oh, no. It was one continuous. Yeah, one continuous. Yep.
So here's my question that I always had problems with if I tried to do that. When you were putting those together, you didn't break any of those fingers off since with the grain?
Probably out of 20 boards, I probably only broke 2 or 3 fingers. I mean, 20 lamps, so that'd be 4 boards. Very few. I bought a good blade set. My first one was a Harbor Freight, and I could just feel the vibration when it cut. So I bought a really good set and just really took my time when I was cutting the grooves. It felt like I was forcing it. Another thing I made, which I made an angle jig for my table saw, you know, they were 9 inches at the base, like 5 inches at the height. So I had to have that angle on all four boards. So I forget exactly what it was. I just playing around with this. It's been a while because it's been 7 years now.
Right.
So I had two pieces of quarter by 3/4 flat aluminum, and I made a piece across at the bottom. But that one closest to my saw blade had another piece, so I could offset it, I think like a 1-inch taper, and bolt it down, and I would cut one side of the boards. Well, then if you flip that board to that taper, it would just be a parallel. So you had to put another 1-inch taper in it to offset drill that hole. So I would cut my angle of my boards on my table saw using that jig I made also. You just had to be careful, make sure when you're backing up, you didn't run it into your saw blade.
Right, yeah.
It had a little piece that hung out on the edge that would push the bore forward, you know, and you cut all of them on one side, then offset it another 1-inch taper per 16 inches, and then do the other side of the board that hadn't been cut yet.
Well, that's really cool, and especially since you didn't really have a woodworking background, so you kind of had to figure all this out on your own.
Yeah, I didn't have any wood. When I started LCB, I barely nailed two 2x4s together. I did everything with metal. My theory was that damn wood, yeah. I couldn't weld it back together when I screwed it up, you know.
Yeah, you can weld your mistakes closed.
You got metal work, you can build it back up.
I wanted to know that because that jig would have to be really accurate so that you didn't force those joints, because typically on a long grain like that, if you would had to force a finger, that you could break them pretty darn easy that way,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And because I've tried that, and I tell you something, I've never had any success at. That's why I was really asking you that. I could get a few of them, but I wouldn't want to have to make that many of them. You know, to get that many fingers to go together in that direction is a tough thing. It's hard enough on bringing in grain. So.
And I could set up on my table and get my wood glue and just put it down all the joints, and I could just squeeze them lamps together, and it would just force out the glue. But it was just like oil was on it. They were so tight. It was amazing, you know. I was proud of it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you should be. And then, like I said, that's a really neat idea. I bet they were beautiful, too, you know, with that long grain going that way. And a very incredible jig. I swear one of these days I'm going to see if I can't make a jig like that. Of course, I don't have the machine shop to get all my little holes.
Well, if somebody needs it, somebody wants to figure out how long their board is and send me two of them, because I can use one on the bottom of my vise and drill it. Do it. I can drill the holes for somebody. That ain't no problem. And now I'm thinking about it. I think I drilled them 1.5 apart, because the way the fingers are, they would be 1.5 apart, not 3/4. If you went exactly 3/4 over, you just cut the finger off that you just left. So it'd be 1.5 on center is what those holes would be drilled. Yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah. Dan, a couple more questions. So I know you're married. Tell us a little about your family and where you live and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, we're still not married, officially married. I proposed to Jennifer on the Steve Harvey show in 19, and then we were going to get married, and then COVID hit, and just ain't ever done it since. But so it's just me and my fiance, and we got 3 dogs, and we live in Columbus, Georgia. This is the city that I was born and raised in. And Jennifer had been in just a little over a year when I had my wreck. She was at the track with me. And when I came out of my coma, they told me I was blind for life. I just immediately knew I was going to commit suicide. I didn't think there was anything I'd left me on this planet. And so I just begged her to go home and back to Birmingham and forget about me. I told her to go to my house, just get wherever you want. Just take it with you. Just forget about me. And my words were, I ruined my life, so don't ruin yours by trying to do the right thing by me. But luckily, she hard-headed. You know? So she's still here. But she likes cars. She actually was working for a professional motorcycle race team in the marketing department in the hospitality when we met. So she understands life. And the night I had my dream that I was going to build my motorcycle, I never went back to sleep that night because I got what I call the curse of the inventive mind. Once it starts thinking about something, it won't stop. She woke up the next morning. I said, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to build a motorcycle and race Bonneville. She said, okay. She told everybody she knew I was fighting depression, and that the change in my attitude was enormous, and she knew that at that moment I was going to be okay because I had a purpose at that point.
Yeah, I think, because I met you before that, and I think you have probably gotten a different attitude after that. You know, I think I met you when you were preparing for that race, you know.
Mm-hmm.
My brain is so old, I can't remember too much anymore, but how old are you now, Dan?
I'm 53. Yeah.
53. Just a kid.
I don't know. After what all this body went through, they had to totally reconstruct my right arm. I got a titanium rod in between my shoulder and elbow, and I still have 3 plates and 14 screws in my right elbow. And my right hand, all the nerves are jacked up because of damage to the elbow. But my worst injury, I tell everybody, is my traumatic brain injury. It's not my blindness. The blindness is what everybody sees. Mm-hmm. The brain injury is what I fight with the most every day. You know, I had some amazing job. 3 years ago, I was a part-time parapro teaching machine shop at a regular sighted high school. You know, something that nobody in the world would give a blind person a chance to do. And I was able to do it. And proficiently and good at it, but the stress and the headache and the neuro fatigue, it wasn't sustainable for me. So I just knew at that point I had to come home and sort of carve my own destiny out here in the shop and try to figure out something that I could do and make a little extra money, you know?
Right. Yeah. That brain injury stuff is,
it's horrible.
I think science is just now really the last few years really learning about how important that is, you know?
I got hit by a car when I was about 7 years old, right in the front of my head, 2-layer stitches, jacked up. You know, everybody told you, mama, lick her finger, stick it on you, wipe the dirt off, and go on about your business. Nobody thought about injuries or head concussions. And now, like I said, science has come out much, and it's by far so much worse than blindness. It's tough.
It is. It is tough. And honestly, I battle chronic depression almost my whole life. And if I could get rid of one or the other, the blindness or the depression, I get rid of the depression.
Oh, yes. I tell everybody.
There's no rhyme or reason to it. You know, it just does whatever it wants to do when it wants to do it. And
I tell everybody, if I went to the doctor's office, he said, I got one magic pill. I can cure your blindness or your brain injury. I would still come home blind because I would choose to cure my brain injury by far.
Yeah, I understand that completely. And before we open this up too much to everybody who wants to talk to you, I have one more question because I know that you go out and do speaking engagements and, you know, you're a big advocate for the blind community. And I wonder if you just touch on that a little bit, maybe tell us the last couple that you've done.
Yes. So recently we took my Corvette. A friend of mine is pretty high up at corporate McDonald's, and it wasn't an official corporate McDonald's event, because I'm just now going to start trying to file for my 501c3, and I think that'll help. It's tough to get in an official corporate vendor. But we put together a deal with his IT team and some other people. We took my car to the Audubon Country Club in Joliet, Illinois. So that's a country club for race car people. They got two road racing tracks. One, I think, is 3.5 miles long. One is 2.5 miles long. And there's condos with garages. I mean, the team said this place looks like a golf course. It's perfectly manicured. You know, and rich people have their Maseratis or Aston Martins or Ferraris, and they park them and they won't go play. They just go down and play. Well, so we went and I spoke. We had the Corvette. We put it inside their event center and talked about my story, my comeback, but then blended it into how accessibility was such a vital part of every milestone that I've accomplished since I went blind, to let them know that how important their job is and to take accessibility serious on the front end, not try to make it a patch on the back end. It hit home with them, and hopefully next year I'll go back if I can get my 501 status and speak to more people at McDonald's. So I'm trying to get that started, the speaking career, trying to start this nonprofit. What my goal is here, Mike Newman in England had the record I broke. He has a charity called Speed of Sight, and they have a fleet. He has about 10 or 12 dual control vehicles, and they rent road race tracks, and they blind and people with other disabilities, whether it's physical, autistic, other challenges, they can come and drive the vehicles on a road race track with an instructor, you know, riding with them. I want to do that, sort of have some track days, but I want to put a little spin on it. I want it to be off-road, these like side-by-side razors. They're so popular, and be able to have track days at off-road parks and let people, you know, the blind experience climbing these really steep inclines and going down and bouncing and leaning. And I think that'd be so much more feedback that we would enjoy more than maybe 30, 40, 50 miles an hour around a road race track that's, granted, that's fast, but you're in a car that's prepared to handle for it. I think the off-road deal will be more exciting. And me and Mike talk all the time. We talked this morning for almost 45 minutes, and he has a few off-road vehicles in his fleet, and he said by far they seem to be the funnest for people. So that's my goal, is to start a charity and be able to hopefully have some vehicles, and I can travel around America and have some blind track days for people to come out and join us.
Well, that sounds really, really amazing to me. I think I'd like to go try that racetrack out, because maybe now that I can't see, that speed wouldn't bother me so much, you know.
People ask me, what was it like driving my Corvette 212 miles an hour blind? I say, I have no idea what the hell's going on, because I have molded earbuds in my ears so I can hear my guidance system. Then I put duct tape over my ears, and I got a helmet. And then my Corvette, when I designed it, it's got three mufflers on it, so it'll be quiet so I can hear the guidance system. So I said, can't hear anything, can't see anything. There's no wind noise because all the windows rolled up. The thing's super aerodynamic. I said, so, you know I'm going fast, but I don't feel the sensation how fast I'm going until I pull the parachute. And that thing, when it blossoms and tugs, and I said, okay, that thing was doing something then, you know. The feedback from the Corvette isn't near as much as you think it would be. The sensation of speed. The Corvette is an extreme exercise in concentration.
I can only dream or imagine that, you know. What engine do you have in that Corvette?
It's a 440 cubic inch LS3 base motor. So it makes 800 horsepower without the nitrous and a little over 1,000 with the nitrous turned on.
That's really cool. Well, Dan, I appreciate you being on here. Like I said, you're such an interesting guy. I always enjoy talking to you.
I appreciate it.
I think you will do some great things for the community. I wish it's a shame we can't get you more back into woodworking, but the pins are actually really cool. You know, I had to make a bunch of pins on the lathe just to give away his little Christmas presents here this past week, and I was thinking about you, but I wonder if this is easier in a machine shop than it is. We wouldn't have to deal with all this dust.
So my pins, you know, I have to drill and ream the inside diameter within a half a thousandth, like the brass tubes are. And then the slims, I put a knurl down there at the grip where your fingers go. And then my executives, my cigar style, I put six rows of ball nose dimples in there. So that's another setup on the mill machine. And then, you know, obviously they have to be drilled and reamed. And when I part the pin bodies to length, I only give myself about a plus or minus 5,000th tolerance. Because if you don't, you know, how easy is to get where your cartridge don't come out right. It's quite a process.
Yeah.
And then I have this really killer pin press that I made out of a Harbor Freight Arbor press that has a small turret at the bottom. It's got stations for each assembly process. Cause like my cigars, you know, there's each end and then where the nibs are, I pressed them. I made the part that pressed that out of Delrin, and it's got the taper that matches the nibs and, you know, keep them getting scratched. And it's quite a process to make them. And then I get them Cerakoted different colors and I bring them home and assemble them.
Yeah. And all nothing in your pin is a kit, right? It's, you're making all the pieces.
No, the slims and the executives, I use the same pin kits y'all do. You know, the woodworkers do.
Oh, you do? Yep.
I just throw away the barrels, the brass tubes. I just throw those away. Well, actually, I save in a bucket. But the transmission, you know, the nib and the clip and all that is the same. But my Made in America pin, I make everything from scratch. The clip on my Made in America pin starts life as a piece of 7/8 hex solid aluminum. And it takes me about 2 hours of machine work just to get it to where it's a clip. And that's just one of the parts that are all threaded together.
Oh, yeah. I think I missed that someplace in the description that's the one you do 100% on.
Then. Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
That is so cool. We're going to go ahead and open it up. If anybody out there has any questions, want to talk to Dan?
Fire away.
Hey, Dan. Jeff Thompson.
Hey, Jeff.
In your racing, when you're going super fast, I know as blind people, we have voiceover, we have this, that, the other thing, and it gets kind of information overload sometimes when you're trying to do three things, or if you're sitting across from someone else doing the same thing, it gets nerve-wracking listening to someone's jaws or something going. How did you develop the technology and everything and deal with information overload when you're feeling the car, you're feeling everything, listening to this, and then your XY axis, staying on the road? How did you work that out with your buddy?
So the first guidance system for the motorcycle, the first weekend we tested it, it was exactly that. It was giving me way too much information, way too slow, and I just couldn't process it. And I said, we just got to, you know, I don't need this. I don't need this. I need this. So way it works is we plot the center line of the racetrack at the extreme ends of both ends of the racetrack. So we set the record at the spaceport in New Mexico. So it's a 2.5 mile flat concrete one way. It's pretty new. So the computer calculates a center line. Well, one of the things the guidance system has is a gyro in it that can detect 0.1 degree of yaw steering. So if I go off to the right or left, I get a tone in that ear. So the further off center I go, the tone increases like doo-doo-doo. So if the tone is steady, say it's in my right ear, but steady, I know I'm going straight parallel. I just might be a little off. And it depends on how the tone is, tells me how far. Now I start trying to bring it back in. A few hundred feet from the finish line, it calls out parachute, then at finish line, it caused that stop. So we took out a lot of stuff that I didn't need for that exact reason, because I'm listening to those tones, man, it's tough. They only put the timing clocks 30 feet apart on a 150-foot runway when I set the record. So I'm starting off a mile and a half away, and a mile and a half later and 200 miles an hour later, I got to shoot between a 30-foot wide path. But it took hundreds of hours of practicing. In 2021, I took the car to Arkansas to try to test it after we changed a bunch of stuff for the guidance system for the Leno deal, and it was a complete failure. So I knew right then, I said, I have a way that I can practice easy, because the race car, it's a pure thoroughbred. It takes 45 minutes to prep it, to turn around and make another pass. So I said, I need something cheap that I can just beat up at the drag strip and practice. So I put it on the internet, and a friend of mine had a 1994 Corvette that was rough, but it ran good. It was automatic, and the air conditioner blew cold, because that way in the summertime, I could practice back to back to
That's
back.
That's important.
Yeah. Well, I could practice back to back to back without the windows being down and the wind noise.
Right.
So Patrick, the engineer, he lives in Huntsville, Alabama. He has his own private plane. So he would fly down here to Columbus. I only live about 2 miles from the airport. I'd find somebody to go pick him up. He'd come to the house, and me and him would drive to my local drag strip and practice about 3 or 4 hours. And then he would fly home. And that was all my brain could handle, was those 3 or 4 hours. I was wiped out for a complete day from all the concentration. And we actually took that Corvette to Spaceport, the practice car, because we were fighting some problems. I spec'd the torque converter too tight. And so the guy was having a hard time getting it idle in gear. And the first day of the Spaceport rental, we had a 50-mile-an-hour crosswind. Typically, land speed racing stops at 17 miles an hour. Me and Patrick would get out in the practice car, and I'd get it up about 110, 120 and just cruise for the mile and a half with a 10-foot wide strip. Because he's sitting there riding shotgun, monitoring everything with the laptop, how wide I'm deviating everything else. And then same thing, I could go about 45 minutes, so I'd say I got to take a break because of the sensory overload.
That's just incredible, yeah. Being a professional, anything is always easy, is it? Takes a lot of practice, a lot of skill.
I tell everybody, if race cars are easy, then sell them at Kmart.
Hey, Dan.
Uh-huh.
It's Albert. The record that you broke, was it Bert Johnson's record by any chance?
No, it was held by Mike Newman in England.
Oh, okay.
Mike had it at 200.5, and I think Mike has had like 12 Guinness records. He's got some in a plane, a boat, motorcycle, car. He was the first blind man over 200, but he was the one that held it at the time that I was able to set the record.
Okay, because Bert Johnson is a guy from British Columbia. I used to work with him over at the Canadian National Institute for the Blind. I think his record was 144 miles an hour in Bonneville in a 77 Corvette.
Huh.
But that's way back in the 90s. So.
I wonder if he's still alive. I like to talk to him.
No. He passed away in the late 90s, sadly, to brain cancer. But
okay.
He's one of these guys that... The last car he saw before he lost his vision was a 55 Thunderbird, and he always dreamt of one. So he eventually owned one, totally restored it. Plus, he restored a 65 Mustang and a 79 Firebird.
Oh, wow.
So he just never lost the passion for good old cars.
That's cool.
All right. Well, great to hear your story. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Albert. You know, back in the... mid-90s, I used to be kind of a car guy, I'm a hacker like I do most things, but I was restoring a Fiat, a 76 Fiat Spider, and I had a bad air compressor motor, and I knew that, but I would always just unplug it when I went in the house, and I forgot to unplug it, and it burnt my shop down, it burnt my car, it burnt everything, and I've never worked on a car, I don't think, really, since, because it just sort of broke my heart to have to start all over, and so I just had built my garage back up, and it was just a stick building that, you know, we parked the van in. And so I found Larry and got into the woodworking thing again. There's always different paths for everything you do.
When you mention air compressors, Harbor Freight's got a quiet air compressor now. I just bought one for the shop because I can't stand my little pancake compressor. But this one at Harbor Freight's only 60 decibels. You can have a conversation standing next to this air compressor running in the shop. You might need a little small air compressor at home.
Well, I might go look at that, because my big one is just, I really can't stand it anymore, you know.
Yeah, that I'll pop a tire with a bicycle pump, but damn near, if I have to turn on my compressor, I have to.
Yeah. You know. Yeah.
Hey, Dan, this is Ray Wright.
Hey, Ray.
It's great to hear you again. I got to share a little thinking of you. I was in a couple months ago. I was over in Maui, and my friend's neighbor across the street, he restores cars, and he just finished restoring a 99 M5 Corvette, I think it was.
C5 Corvette. Yep.
Convertible. And
yep.
Yeah, he took me race around the island in it, and yeah, it was a lot of fun. We only got up to, I think he said, 75 or 80, because he said it could get up to 200, but he didn't want me to have to do the dishes in the prison. So,
that's cool. Yeah, that.
I know yours was a 2008, but what's the difference between an M5 or whatever the different models are?
So the 97 to the 2004 is what you wrote in is called a C5.
Oh, okay.
And then mine from 2005 to 14 is a C6. Then they went to the 7, 8. And then now they're on the C8s is the newest one. I'm sorry. And that's just the era. You know, obviously start C1 in 53 when they built the first Corvette. But yeah, so the C5 is very similar shape to mine. It has pop-up headlights where mine has fixed headlights. But those C5 through C7s have motors up front, but the transmissions are in the rear for better front to rear weight bias. They're almost perfectly 50-50. And now the new C8s are a mid-engine car, more like a Ferrari style. That's how a lot of higher-end supercars have always been mid-engines.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that's, yeah, I knew you were the person to ask about that. It was pretty cool. And I remember when you started up your car when we were talking one day, you started up the Corvette, and I expected to hear this real loud, you know, race car, dragster. Oh, yeah. And heck, a car outside, the regular cars, was a lot louder than yours. It was so quiet.
Yeah.
I was amazed.
Yeah, when I designed the exhaust system, it's got three mufflers. Now, they're race mufflers. It's all 3-inch stainless tubing front to rear, but I knew I had to have it quiet so I could hear the guidance system. And if you go on YouTube and you search Steve Hartman, Dan Parker, there's a little segment they did on CBS News. And when I hear the car from the outside, I'm like, damn, that thing's louder than I thought it was. But on the inside, it's quiet, you know. And the plus, we put 5 layers of sound deadening material. It's called lizard skin. We sprayed the whole front to back inside the car, inside the doors, just doing everything I could to make it as quiet as possible.
So, Dan, how much does it cost to rent the whatever that was where you just sat for a day or whatever?
The spaceport. Rent from 3 days, about $40,000. It ain't cheap.
That's amazing. Hence why you get sponsors, right?
Yeah. And they cut me some slack, put it that way. Because when I was there from the Leno show, they knew me. And actually, I'm the first person ever set a Guinness record at spaceport. So they was wanting it. They were awesome because my contract ran out on Friday at 5 o'clock. I forgot to mention this earlier, but when I set the record, it was exactly 10 years to the day of the wreck, almost down to the hour. But on the last day, we were fighting all those issues. I hadn't even cracked 200 miles an hour yet. And I went down to the left front of my truck and just sat down against the truck, and I sat down and prayed. And I told God, I said, if this ain't in your will for me to have this record, I'll accept that. I said, then all I ask of you, next time I crank this car out, throw all the connector rods out the side and give my team a reason we failed. Don't let them go through the gates with their tails tucked, you know. And a few minutes later, Jason, my co-pilot, the car's got 2 steering wheels. So while we're testing all this guidance system stuff, there's an emergency, somebody can take over. But they wanted a passenger there. The guy that did the timing, Jason, he's been 269 miles an hour in his Corvette. Me and him are really good friends. And he rode shotgun, but we had to provide GoPro video footage for the Guinness official to prove he didn't help me any. But about noon, I went to the officials at spaceport, and I told them, I said, listen, you know, I said, obviously we're struggling. I've been here for, you know, 2.5 days at this point. I said, I know my contract runs out at 5 o'clock. Do I got any options? And she told me, she said, listen, you just keep fighting. Let me worry about that. And I didn't know it, but there's already been talk that they were going to let me run till dark that night. And then I had to about 10 the next morning if we couldn't get it happen.
That's really cool.
But when I went to spaceport, I had everything imaginable. I had a TIG welder, a spare motor, spare differentials, all complete set of brakes, extra set of wheels and tires. Because when you're out in the middle of the desert, 75, 80 miles from anybody.
Right. Yeah.
If you break anything, you got to have it in the trailer or you're wasting 3 or 4 hours. And so you can't do it. So, man, I over-prepared and, you know, we overcame it in the last few hours. made it happen.
What is Spaceport?
So that's where it's an 18,000, maybe more than that, acre facility out in the middle of the desert, west of El Paso, Texas. And they have a vertical launch facility for rockets, et cetera, and a horizontal launch facility. That's the runway that I was running on. And that's where, like, Richard Branson has that Virgin Galactic space plane that he can fly people up in the lower orbit. Mm-hmm. They can feel weightlessness and land back. And that's where they take off. And they do all kinds of, I think, other testing, possibly for the military and stuff there, too.
Oh, okay, okay.
Dan, can you say your motto one more time?
You can make excuses or make it happen.
I like that.
I do, too.
Yeah. Every one of my PM Slims and my executives, they come in a wooden box. And that's laser engraved on the box. Of course, my Made America's, that's laser engraved on the bases also.
Who does your laser engraving?
A local lady does it. Her husband, they're both veterans, and they do arts and crafts and laser engraving, etc. And she does it for me.
Oh, okay.
Your motto sounds a little bit like Henry Ford. If you think you can, or if you think you can't, you're right.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Dan, the car I gave up when I lost my sight, I decided to hang on to woodworking, but I gave up on my 58 Chevy Impala. But I sold it to my brother. It took 7 pickup truck loads to get it over to his place because I was in the process of restoring it. And I sold it to him because he's a body man, and I knew he would actually put it back together. And so now I get to fondle the fenders and stroke the upholstery whenever I want to.
That's cool.
It's kind of fun. I got to drive it a bunch of years ago. It was like 13, 14 years after I had to give up driving. And my brother finally talked me into driving it. He kept saying to me, he says, Albert, you got to drive your car. And I kept saying, no, I'm good. I'm over it. I don't need to. Finally, one day I decided to humor him because he needed me to drive my old wreck. And, you know, after, 13 or 14 years of not driving, it was like I had parked that car in the driveway the night before. Mm-hmm. You know, the clutch and the gas pedal and the shifter, he had restored it to, exactly the way I had it when I was driving it. And God, did that ever feel like magic to get behind the wheel of that thing and just drive it around the fall fairground. It was really a magical experience.
Yeah, that's cool. And that's what I want to do for my charity, Just think how many blind kids have never driven anything. And I tell people, I say, if you ask 100 blind people what's the one thing they want to do, I say 75 is going to say drive. We just won't experience it, And nothing is like, the freedom of driving.
Hi, Dan. This is Scott Wheat. I really love your idea because you're completely right about the feedback, sensations, whatever, about riding in the side-by-sides, because I've gone out in the side-by-side with either my wife or my son driving. It really is fun. And to be able to actually do some of the driving would just be a kick.
Yeah. Down south here, we got all kinds of off-road parks. And I called one owners and told her what my plans were. She says, we have a complete obstacle course set up and we're closed during the weeks because they open on the weekends for everybody rides and hangs out and parties, et cetera. And she said, during the week, we're closed and you can have your own event and nobody be right here in the body and everything be good. And I just think when a blind person goes up and starts climbing up a 45-degree incline, and they're like, oh, they're going to feel it, so much more than other things,
And Dan, I think it's critical. It's Albert again. It's critically important that there's that sensation because there's a river near here that I've always dreamt of tubing down this river. It's like a 3 or 4 hour ride on a tube down this river. And always wanted to do it. And I finally got to do it last year or the year before last. And with no vision, tubing on a river has absolutely zero sensation until you get to like a set of rapids.
Yeah.
Like if there's nothing to feel, you can't see the earth going by you. You can't see the rocks going under you. There's just nothing. You're sitting there in suspended animation until you hear, you feel a rough patch in the river. So certainly that off-road driving, man, that would be something I would love to be able to do just to feel the bump. I love a small airplane because there's some sensation, right? There's some bumps to feel. You know you're doing something.
And that's my thoughts. And that's the reason I'm, Mike has done just amazing work. He had 14 track days this year over in England. And he's been doing it for years and growing it. He's been pushing me to do this for years. And you got to think about it. Man, just the side-by-side to be very easy to convert to dual control. They're so much cheaper. You can find a good used 800 one for about $7,000 or $8,000. Once I get on my feet and get my nonprofit status and hope to start raising some money, I want to have a stacker trailer. I've already designed a trailer in my head, open trailer that hauls 3 up top and 3 down low So I'll take 6 side-by-sides to the event and let people rotate them out, driving them, I think would be really cool for everybody to experience.
It does sound really cool. By the way, Albert, you know, when you're going down that river on that tube, that's called relaxing.
But when there's no sensation, there's no sound, there's just nothing. Just the eagles in the sky is all, because we're on the West Coast, right? And I was shocked. I had wanted this so badly for so many years, because I've been blind about 40 years now. I just was so expecting so many sensations and just got this great big fat ball of nothing. Yeah, it was really amazing. So, yeah, you need some bumps on the road or you ain't there, right?
Yep.
This is Ray again. We, through the Blind Center, have gone snowmobiling out here in Utah, and that's been a lot of fun going up and down and around and hearing the power of the snowmobile and all of that, and having someone on the back telling you which way to turn and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, I think you've got something going on there.
Yeah, I bet that was really fun.
This is Andrew. Last Christmas, I was up at my daughter's house in Idaho, and they took us tubing down a ski slope. That was an adventure that you might enjoy.
There you go, Albert.
Now that one gave you some feedback, didn't it?
It most certainly did.
I live amongst the mountains here. Jeez, I haven't tried that yet.
There you go.
Yeah, we've gone tubing. They actually have some tubing where they had the Olympics here in 2002 in Park City. They've got some tubing courses. And when they tell you that you'll stop at the end of it, don't believe them, because they have a big cargo net at the end of the course. And I ended up flying over the berm and ending up like a bait in a spider web or something. I was all twisted up. And
you stopped, didn't you?
Yeah, it worked. If it didn't, I would have been in the parking lot. So
so they didn't lie to you.
Yeah.
You know, early when I first started to lose my sight, I went snow skiing once here on some of the local mountains, and I just thought, there is no freaking way I'm going to put 2 boards on the bottom of my feet and go sliding down the side of a mountain. Just, you know, nothing's going to go wrong, right? There's trees and bumps. And no, I haven't done it since. So, but a tube, I know it's a big fat tire. Maybe it'll bounce off the trees a bit better. Yeah, I've done water skiing.
Yeah, I can still water ski.
Mm-hmm. I'll only water ski if I trust the driver implicitly. I won't get behind anybody's boat. I've got to trust them before I'll do it.
Well, the skiing, the downhill skiing can be done. We did it a lot when I was a kid, developed some good ways to do it with my parents, and it worked out well. It was fun. I'm still alive to talk about it, so it worked out.
Hell, I'm scared now because alligators were, you know, pretty good ways up into Georgia. Now alligators are everywhere here. You know, when I was a kid, there was no alligators. It was all in Florida. Now they're gradually going further north, and I'm like, no, I don't think I'm getting in the river here no more. I don't feel like being bait, you know.
That's why we don't visit you, Dan.
Yeah, that's fine.
I think I'll stay up here in the north with the snow. We don't have gators up here yet.
I refer to that as white rain. I want nothing to do with it.
Hey, Mr. Dan, this is Daryl. I really appreciate you being on the call. I really enjoyed it. I always enjoy talking to you. You're just the most fascinating person, and
well, I appreciate it.
I really appreciate all your time and everything that you do, man.
No problem. I appreciate y'all inviting me and having me on. And check out that finger joint jig. You can just go to YouTube and just search Dan Parker finger joint jig. And I hope maybe give an explanation and check it out.
Oh, I'm going to look that up. You keep that on that.
I appreciate the invite and always enjoy reading everybody's posts. And y'all take care. Good night.
Be sure to check out www.4b.org, Woodworkers for the Blind. Become part of the community and learn from others. Hope you enjoyed, and until next time, bye-bye.